This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There's not a lot of people who love show tunes and avant-garde music, even fewer who can perform both well. So let me introduce you to Theo Bleckman, who is full of vocal surprises. He's been a part of the New York downtown music scene for over 15 years. He's performed with Meredith Monk, John Zorn, Laurie Anderson, and the Bang on a Can All-Stars, and has been a soloist with the Estonian Radio Choir, Merce Cunningham Dance Company, and Mark Morris Dance Group. Bleckman's 2006 collection of show tunes and pop songs, Las Vegas Rhapsody, was described in The Village Voice by jazz critic Francis Davis as the most transcendent vocal album in many a moon. Bleckman moved to New York in 1989 from his native Germany. His new CD, Berlin, Songs of Love and War, Peace and Exile, features songs by Kurt Weill, Bertolt Brecht, Hanns Eisler, and others. On this track, Theo Bleckman sings Surabaya Johnny from the Brecht-Weill musical Happy End.
Ich war jung, Gott, erst 16 Jahre. Du kamst von Burma herauf. Du sagtest, ich soll mit dir gehen. Du kämest für alles auf. Ich fragte nach deiner Stellung. Du sagtest, so war ich hier steh. Du hättest zu tun mit der Eisenbahn und nichts zu tun mit der See. Du sagtest viel, Johnny, kein Wort war wahr, Johnny. Du hast mich betrogen, Johnny, zur ersten Stunde. Ich hasse dich so, Johnny, wie du dastehst und grinst, Johnny. Nimm doch die Pfeife aus dem Maul, du Hund. So. Und ich liebe dich so. Surabaya, Johnny. Warum bin ich nicht froh? Du hast kein Herz, Johnny. Und ich liebe
Theo Bleckman, welcome to Fresh Air. That's such a really good version of Surabaya, Johnny. Would you talk about what the lyric means?
Well, the lyric is a love song, pining for somebody that no longer loves him and was abusive. And that is the gist, the core of the song. Of course, it's usually sung by a woman, but in this case, I'm singing it as a man. From a man to a man.
So you're out as a singer?
Yes.
Good.
Out as a singer, out as a person.
Okay. No, I particularly like the spoken part in that song. Mm-hmm. It's like you're acting the song.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe you could talk a little bit about doing that kind of Sprechstimme? What's the Brechtian word for it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Where it's part spoken, part sung.
Exactly. It's sort of that in-between place where there's no pitch, but you're still somewhat singing the phrases. It's a very strange place. I feel very connected to that lyric because I have been in a relationship like that, not with physical abuse, but, abusive otherwise. And so it felt very close to my heart. I didn't have to really search that long to really find a place that I could connect to in this case.
Now, most of the songs on your new CD, Berlin, are songs with lyrics by Bertolt Brecht.
Mm-hmm.
You grew up in Germany.
Yes.
What did Brecht's songs mean to you in Germany when you were living there?
Nothing.
Glad I asked. Really? So did you not know them until you moved to America?
I did know them, but from a far distance, and I wouldn't have touched them. But when I came here, I work a lot in in music that has no words. And I work a lot in music that has English lyrics, and most of all, sometimes very abstract lyrics. So for me to sing this material was a far stretch at first. And then when I realized how close I actually felt, how closely related I felt to them, it was actually quite overwhelming, because it's part of my history, and it's also part of the history of this country right now in terms of the political context that these songs on this record especially have. So it was sort of a homecoming for me.
Well, we heard Surabaya Dirjani, which is a song about someone whose lover is has been abusing them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to change the tone a little bit and play another track. And this is a song with a lyric by Bertolt Brecht and music by Hans Eisler.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll ask you to pronounce it, but it's Als ich in meinem Liebe trug.
Als ich dich in meinem Leib trug.
Yeah, that's what I meant to say. And this is a much more like march-like and in some parts dissonant song. Tell us what it means in English and why you chose to sing it.
This is one song of a little suite that we actually took apart on the record. But it's four songs of a working mother song to her unborn child, in which she tells the child that you are coming into a very difficult and sad world, and that they're already planning victories with your little body. But there's a little bit of hope in those songs, too, in saying that I hope that you will stand up against tanks and generals and fight against them. So that's sort of the gist of these four songs, and that's one of them.
And that explains the march-like beat.
Yes.
So this is Theo Bleckman from his latest CD, Berlin, Songs of Love and War, Peace and Exile.
Als ich dich in meinem Leib trug, war es uns gar nicht gut bestellt. Und ich sagte oft, der, den ich trage, kommt in eine schlechte Welt. Und ich nahm mir vor zu sorgen, dass er sich da etwa auch nicht irrt. Den ich trage, der muss Sorgen helfen, dass sie endlich besser wird.
That's singer Theo Bleckman from his latest CD, Berlin. And the song we just heard was written by Hans Eisler and Bertolt Brecht. Well, we established that growing up in Germany, you weren't paying a lot of attention to the music of Bertolt Brecht and Kurt Weill. What were you listening to?
I was listening to American musicals. I was listening to a lot of jazz as I got older and into my teens. And that really took over. I was listening to jazz music and then very, very contemporary classical music. Stockhausen, Henze, John Cage.
Were American musicals popular in Germany? Or was it unusual for someone young like you to be listening to them?
They were on TV, and I would darken the living room and forbid everybody to walk through the living room when a musical was on, because it was... It was my private time with the TV, and then I would find the records for it. I would, at that time, you had to order the records in a record store, and it would take 6 weeks for them to get there. I grew up in a small town, so. But it was a big, exciting day when the record arrived, and I would listen to it until the next one came.
So when you saw American musicals on TV, were they in English?
They were dubbed in German, and then they broke out into English songs. It was the weirdest thing, and you wouldn't question it at all that all of a sudden they're singing in a different voice with English words, except for My Fair Lady, which was overdubbed with German singers.
I see. Uh-huh.
Overdubbed. The text and the dialogue was overdubbed in German.
How strange.
Mm-hmm.
So did it help you? Like, I assume you were singing along in English. Did you already know English?
Yeah, you learn it in school.
You do? Uh-huh.
No, I just, most of it I didn't understand. I always thought in The Wizard of Oz that Judy Garland sang, "I wish I were a porno star and wake up where the clouds are far." But why would she wish that? That is so weird.
Did you really think that?
I really thought that, yeah.
That's great. You were born in 1966.
Mm-hmm.
So you're born, a couple of decades after the war. Did the mm-hmm. war have any impact on you when you were growing up, or did that seem
yes.
like something that was way over?
No. It was very present in my family. My parents were children. My father actually went into the war. He lost a limb in the war. He lost his leg in the Second World War. My parents were quite old when they adopted me, so they were part of that whole generation. Of course, my grandmother too. So there was a lot of history about that in our family. My grandfather, who I never met, but he, from my mother's side, he was a big opponent of the war and of the Nazis, and he got into some trouble in our little town. But and my mother had to go to another school because she didn't want to join the Hitler Youth. So there was a lot of impact. And there's still stories that I get from my mother to this day that are about that time.
Did your father want to fight, or was he forced to fight?
He was forced to fight, yeah. And he went to the Russian front and came back, crippled.
And do you know the story behind your adoption?
I know very little. I tried to find my birth mother. When I turned 30, I got this bee in my bonnet that I would want to do that, especially fueled by all these reunification stories that you see on TV. And so I wrote to the adoption agency through which this process had to be facilitated, and they sent my letter to my birth mother, which they had found, and then she sent a letter back through the agency to me saying that she didn't want to meet me. Didn't want to get to know me. This went on for two more letters, I think, and me saying, I just want to meet you. There's no financial impact, or I'm not a crazy person. But she just didn't want to meet me. So that was the end of that, and I didn't pursue it anymore after that.
Do you feel bad about that?
Well, it was a second adoption, really. It was being adopted for, given up a second time. Maybe my hopes were too high, but it was difficult, I have to say. It was difficult, but it's done. Closed chapter.
Right. My guest is singer Theo Bleckman, and his new CD is called Berlin, Songs of Love and War, Peace and Exile. Most of the songs in there have lyrics by Bertolt Brecht. You know, we talked about how much you loved show tunes growing up mm-hmm. in Germany, and an earlier CD that you did a couple of years ago called Las Vegas Rhapsody has a lot of like show tunes and American pop tunes on in it. Are any of the songs on that album songs that had personal significance from your childhood?
Particularly Out of My Dreams and We Kiss in a Shadow meant a lot to me because those were two of the songs that were on records that I had bought and listened to over and over and over again. I think I got those lyrics right, hopefully.
Those are actually my two favorite tracks on the album. And
thank you,
Terry. I thought we'd play We Kiss in the Shadows. Mm-hmm. And this is from the Rodgers and Hammerstein musical, The King and I. Is that one of the musicals that you watched a lot?
Yes. When they would come on TV, there was no VCR or anything. So maybe once a year.
Well, let's hear it. This is We Kiss in the Shadows, and Fumio Yasuda is accompanying you at the piano. And this is from Theo Bleckman's album, Las Vegas Rhapsody.
We kiss in a shadow, we hide from the moon. Our meetings are few and over too soon. in a whisper, afraid to be heard. When people are near, we speak not a word. Alone in our secret, together we sigh for one smiling day to be free. To kiss in the sunlight and say to the sky, behold and believe what you see. Behold how my lover loves me.
That's Theo Bleckman from his album Las Vegas Rhapsody. And his new CD, Berlin, features German songs, mostly songs with lyrics by Bertolt Brecht. And Theo Bleckman grew up in Germany. How old were you when you moved to the United States?
I was 23.
Now, you mentioned your dream was to be a painter. I had read that you were an ice dancer in Germany. Is that wrong?
That's correct. yes, during my voice break, I needed something else to do, so I went into figure skating. And, you know, after my voice came back, that took back seat.
So what kind of music did you dance to as a figure skater?
Oh, of course, show tunes. Gershwin. one of the routines we did was to a Sweet Charity medley. And Gershwin, I always thought it would be so kooky to use a Webern string quartet or something completely atonal and crazy. But, of course, so many people have the fingers in their pie of what decisions are being made, including costumes and music. And so that was never an option.
What's the greatest costume you wore?
spandex, of course, and lots of glitter on it.
Now, when you talk about your voice break, because you were singing as a boy and you had to wait out the break in your voice, it sounds like, well, you know, taking a little hiatus while my voice breaks. But it must have been kind of scary for you when your voice broke to not know how
scary
it would come back.
Oh, my God, yes. Especially when your identity as a musician, as a child, was so closely linked to that. I remember being in the recording studio and doing a recording at that time, and I thought that licorice would help it go away. So I just kept eating licorice, bag after bag after bag, and it would help. You know, it goes up and down in the beginning, so I thought, oh, this is really working. But of course it didn't. Yeah, it is scary.
For several years, you sang in a group led by Meredith Monk, who is a very extraordinary singer and composer. And her style of singing is influenced by all kinds of singing around the world, from Tuvan throat singing to, you know, Bulgarian choirs. And are there techniques that you learned by working with her that helped you learn about things that your voice could do that you otherwise might not have known about?
It wasn't so much technique that I learned with Meredith. It was finding a motivation or an impetus for each sound that you do. I think one of the many reasons why Meredith's work is so incredibly strong and powerful is that it's not just any old sound making that's clever and fun and interesting, but there's an emotional motivation for everything. And I learned that without that, it means nothing. Without that, you can sing the craziest sounds and, well, isn't that clever, isn't that interesting? But what does it mean? What does it make you feel? Who is this person singing this crazy sound? And that's what we constantly worked on in the ensemble and working on her music. And the same is true for regular singing too, of course. But in sound making, it's not really talked about very much because sometimes people think that sound is enough. I disagree with that. I think that sound isn't always enough.
I'd like our listeners to hear your more contemporary or experimental, whatever you want to call it, that side of you.
Mm-hmm.
Is there something you'd like us to play?
Well, maybe Norwegian Wood, which sort of brings together both of those elements.
Song and adventure.
Mm-hmm. That's nicely put.
You do something in the break of this that sounds kind of like Tuvan throat singing.
Mm-hmm. Which it is, yeah. I worked on my overtone singing some while back and see if I could refine it on my own and work on which overtones I get when, and sort of that part entered this arrangement.
Is there a way, would you be willing to just like demonstrate what it is that you do, like how it sounds and how you get
there?
Well,
the easiest way to start overtone singing is to go into your bathroom, if you have a, you know, especially reverberant bathroom, and start singing your mid to low range on the word bird and stay on the er, especially easy for Americans, especially from Texas. Bird. And play around with the position of the tongue and move it back and forth very slowly and listen to what's coming out.
Is it the lips, too, that you're moving?
Not so much the lips, but the inside of your mouth.
Uh-huh.
The cavities are changing. Mostly the tongue. It's the tongue position.
But when you sing in overtones, it sounds like you're singing several notes at one time.
They just swing along. They just ring along with what I'm singing because they're present. It's like a color spectrum. Each color has other colors in it. The color white has all the colors in it. So I just, by just changing the shape of my mouth, I emphasize red and blue and yellow and purple in the spectrum.
Okay, so let's hear what you do with Norwegian Wood, singing it and doing a little throat singing, overtone singing in there. And this is from an album that you made with the guitarist Ben Maunder, and the CD is called At Night.
I sat on a rug, biding my time, drinking her wine. We talked until 2, and then she said, it's time for bed. She told me she worked in the morning, started to laugh. I told her I didn't and crawled to sleep in the bath. That's
singer Theo Blackman with Ben Maunder on guitar from their album At Night. Because you have such range and flexibility and tonal variety with your voice, I think you've also done some like movie special effects.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Tell us what you've done.
Well, I got a call some years ago from a friend of mine who was engineering a sound improv session for a movie. And he asked me to read this dialogue in the voice of an alien. And I read through this, and it was this person whose head opens, and then this alien comes out of the head, and then this person falls into a plate of pierogies. And so I was supposed to read this, but pretend I was an alien. And I thought, this is the worst movie script I've ever seen in my life. It was just 2 pages, just this one scene. And so I kept, you know, doing one take, and he said, okay, now do it in another way, and I did another take, and this goes on, and after 6 takes, we're like, okay, done. I said, who directs this? This is not even a B movie, this is like an F movie. And he said, this is a Steven Spielberg production called Men in Black.
Men in Black.
Well... That little
movie, yeah.
Yeah.
So, what we'll hear the scene, but tell us what you did vocally.
I just improvised what to me could be alien language, and they asked for it to be lip syncable, so not too crazy, so that people could learn it. I think what ultimately happened in this session was that it was to complicated for them, or I don't know what happened, but usually my biggest pet peeve with these alien voices is that they all have this strange reverb on them, if you've noticed. So there's so much effect on this alien in the movie that I can't even tell if it's my voice or somebody else's voice.
Oh, because it's so processed?
It's so processed. It's so strange. Like, aliens come to this world with a complete reverb chamber and EQ system that surrounds them.
Hey, they have better technology on other planets. So since we won't be able to tell it to you on the film, do you want to just do what you did?
Well, I did something like... Perhaps something like that.
It almost sounds like it was processed in some part.
If you put enough reverb on it, yeah.
So when you moved to America, you were 23. Were you already out in Germany when you moved to the States?
No. No, I still had a girlfriend when I moved here. And the way I was outed in Germany was I was reviewed in a gay magazine for a record that I did, saying that I was gay. And I thought my life would end. I thought, this is it. My life is over. I will have no career. And everybody will hate me. I might as well just, you know, pack it up. And first of all, nobody cares. Nobody reads the thing, first of all. And then secondly, nobody cares. That's the most amazing thing. Nobody cares.
So what year is this?
This was 1991.
So this was a German gay magazine?
Yes.
So did nobody care because nobody cared about you, or did nobody care because the atmosphere was that open that nobody cared that you were gay?
Yeah, exactly. And
open?
Most people,
open?
Open, and most people will say, oh, we already knew. Hello, you were ice skating.
You were ice skating to show tunes.
Yes.
With glitter costumes, yes. So, do you still skate?
No. The last time I went skating was with a good friend of mine, Maria Schneider, who used to be a figure skater herself.
Oh, she's a jazz composer and arranger. Yeah.
Yes, and we went figure skating in Central Park when the Christo installation was up, and that was really fun. But after an hour, I can't even stand it anymore because my feet start to hurt so much in my old skating boots that I just have to stop.
Right. Okay.
And it's kind of depressing. You can do one trick and that's it. You know, one little pirouette or one lame little jump. That's no fun anymore.
You've worked with, like, sound distortion and manipulation and electronic music and stuff. And the German group Kraftwerk was one of the first groups to bring, like, the pop version of electronic music.
Yes.
And, you know, they had big hits. Did they have any influence on you when you were younger?
Absolutely. I actually perform one of their songs.
No, really?
Yes. With a little Casio keyboard.
Not the Autobahn?
No, it's called The Model. That's a model. I love them. I think they're absolutely genius. I can't say enough about them. I tried to get tickets to their concert last time they were in New York, but it was impossible. I worship at their feet. They're amazing.
So what's the song that you do, The Model?
It's called The Model. She's a model and she's looking good. Is the first line of the lyric.
Can you sing a couple of bars of it?
Sie ist ein Model und sie sieht gut aus. Ich nehme sie heute gerne mit zu mir nach Haus. That's the song.
That's like African clicking that you're doing as you hum, yes?
Yes. I'm trying to be my own Casio.
Have you studied a lot of world singing techniques?
Not really. I think a lot of this stuff is self-evident when you start exploring.
Uh-huh.
I've done a lot of just recording myself, exploring, seeing what I can do. Let's say I would go through the alphabet. I start with the letter A, and I come up with every sound that I can with this, on the vowel A. And then I take the first one, and I make three variations on the first one, etc. So it becomes this tree of variations.
Show me what you mean.
So let's say I have A. Try to get a buzz in there a little bit. Then I make a variation on that one. Put a vibrato in it. Or I go, do it staccato. Then I do another gravelly ah on maybe on a slide. Etc. And then I do, you know, other ahs, other sounds with ah that have different variations. So I write them down and meticulously lay it out and see if I can combine them. So that's where the click comes in, where I have a etc. You know, it's endless. It's an endless game of just trying to find sounds and see what you can do. Sort of like a painter taking their colors and putting them together and mixing them to different degrees and seeing if this one works next to that one, and let's put, you know, more white into that and more this and more that. So it's very simple. But then, and this goes back to Meredith, then the hardest part is, what does it mean? What is this about? Is this just a cool effect, or what am I trying to say here? And this is what I'm constantly struggling with and working on, is why this sound, why that sound? What does it mean to me? And that's when the work starts to, I think, to jam and get more into a deeper place for me.
Well, Theo Blackman, thank you so much for talking with us. And thank you for demonstrating some of the things that you can do with your voice.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Theo Blackman's new CD is called Berlin, Songs of Love and War, Peace and Exile. If you look closely at your credit card bill during this economic downturn, or actually read the fine print in the contract updates you get in the mail, you may be in for some surprises. Here to explain is Harvard Law School professor Elizabeth Warren. She specializes in credit card law and bankruptcy law. Yesterday, she talked with us about credit rating agencies and the mistakes they often make when calculating your credit score. Elizabeth Warren, welcome back to Fresh Air. How are credit card companies responding to the credit crunch that resulted from the subprime mortgage meltdown and the resulting financial crisis?
They're trying to improve their revenues, and they're using two principal tools right now. The first is that they're increasing interest rates and fees all over the place. So you've been making payments on a regular basis on your outstanding credit card at 9.9%. Hey, welcome to the new world. It's now 18.9%. Not because the likelihood you would repay has changed, not because interest rates have changed, indeed they've fallen, but because the company needs the money. And they think that in this time of economic pressure on families, you'll be less likely to bolt at a higher interest rate than you were before.
Because you're more desperate for the money.
Well, or just more worried that you can't find it somewhere else. That's exactly right. So, you know, if they got you, then they're going to squeeze you. And that's part of what's going on right now.
Gee, it's so counterintuitive that interest rates would have fallen in the bank, but interest rates are going up with the credit card agencies.
Isn't that stunning? And always remember, interest rates are just the visible sign of what's happening. The major credit card issuers this spring sent out letters all across America, just plain old raising interest rates. And they did it in a way so that they would minimize the number of people who saw it. So I actually saw some of these letters. They look like kind of your standard form. We have blah, 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 blah. You know, dear customer, you know, it's on a mimeograph sort of thing. And down in the fifth paragraph, it just says, and if we don't hear otherwise from you, we're going to raise your interest rate to 18.99%. And hope that they don't hear otherwise from you. Or in some cases, they don't care because under their contract, they can just change the interest rate whenever they want anyway. So lots of those went out. But always keep in mind, Terry, as we talked about before, there are lots of ways to raise the revenues. And so a large part of what they're doing as well is trying to squeeze in all the other areas that are not as visible. So what used to be a $29 charge becomes a $39 charge. What used to be a $15 charge moves to a $20 charge. All of these have ratcheted up.
You're talking about late fees and things like that.
Late fees, over-limit fees, pay-to-play fees, fees. I mean, they've tucked them in everywhere because the credit card contract is only partly about interest and much more increasingly about all the kind of tricks and traps and ways you can squeeze a nickel here and a dollar there and $20 here and $50 there. That's where the real growth in revenues has been in the last 4 or 5 years. And boy, is that happening now big time. In order to try to bring revenues, suck revenues into the companies to offset losses as people are losing their jobs, as people can't make their other payments, as people are getting into financial trouble, they're putting the big push in fee areas, in double cycle billing, in trailing interest rates, in everything that the typical customer cannot see until it's simply too late.
So a couple of things you've given us to look out for. One is that increasing fees, but also the interest rate that you signed up for might have been raised by a lot very recently because of the credit crunch. So
right.
You're suggesting that we check and see what is our interest rate now, right. Now might be higher than we think it is.
Right. And then there's a third one.
Yeah.
And that is there's more marketing of lousy products. So the offers to buy credit insurance that sounds like, you know, we're going to play on your fears. These are dangerous times. You're nervous. You might lose your job. You know, you could get sick. You don't have health insurance. So there's a lot more marketing. There's been a real step up in marketing of what are really lousy credit products. And I say they're lousy because they're very high priced relative to the amount of insurance you're getting. You may be getting, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of $5,000 worth of insurance and yet paying in the neighborhood of $20 a month. You know, you could do a lot better by getting some other kind of insurance somewhere else. So partly it's about the pricing of this insurance, and partly it's about, quite frankly, many of these so-called insurance policies are designed to try to, shall we say, never pay. You know, that you can't come up with the right documentation. You really can't come up with the right set of conditions that makes it so that the insurance company will pay off. Or if they pay off on some of these, it sounds like when you read the promotional literature, what they're going to do is if you lose your job, they'll cancel your $6,000 outstanding credit card. No, it's if you lose your job, they'll continue to carry your $6,000 balance, but they'll suspend interest for 6 months. That's not very much protection. So there's a real step up in these revenue generators. They're frankly just crummy deals.
Have you been getting any new come-ons in the junk mail at your home?
So I got a new one this morning. And the new come-on was a gift card that if I would sign up for what was described as a wonderful opportunity with my credit card company, I had this $15 gift card that I could go use. And gift cards have become the new freebie, I think, the new way to seduce people in. Because as soon as I use the gift card, what happens is it will trigger my having signed up for a year's worth of this really lousy, in my case, this really lousy credit insurance that would cost me money far more than the $15 I would have gotten on the gift card.
Elizabeth Warren, thank you so much.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Elizabeth Warren is a Harvard Law School professor. Joseph O'Neill writes regularly for The Atlantic Monthly and is the author of two novels and a memoir, Blood Dark Track, that was a New York Times notable book. But book critic Maureen Corrigan says that O'Neill's latest novel is in a class by itself. For one thing, it got her interested in the game of cricket. Here's her review.
The strategy is so obvious, so inevitable, you wonder why it took so long for a writer to carry it out. What I'm talking about is the idea to write a novel about post-9/11 New York City as viewed through the scrim of F. Scott Fitzgerald's masterpiece, The Great Gatsby. Gatsby is the great American novel about dreaming, overreaching, and loss. But what many people forget is that it's also a great novel about New York City. Remember that immortal ending where our wistful narrator, Nick Carraway, talks about how when the green breast of the New World, Manhattan, appeared before Dutch sailors' eyes, it was the last time in history when man beheld an object commensurate with his capacity to wonder? It's all over, Carraway is saying in that ending. The age of discovery, the vision of America as a land of endless potential, the promise of roaring 20s New York City. It's finished, kaput. We live in a permanent state of aftermath, which is where Joseph O'Neill's marvelous novel, Netherland, begins. Our narrator here is, loosely speaking, a latter-day Dutch sailor who's washed up on the ragged shores of Lower Manhattan. Hans Vandenbroek is an equities analyst whose English wife, Rachel, has left him and gone back to England, taking their young son with her. In the shuddering wake of 9/11, Rachel tells Hans that she's been questioning the narrative of their marriage. He, in turn, burrows into a dank apartment in the infamous Chelsea Hotel, longtime home to suicidal rock stars and other desolation angels of the city. Through a fluke encounter with a cab driver, the drifting Hans is drawn into the fraternity of cricket players in New York City. Hans had played the sport as a child in Holland, but he discovers that in contemporary New York, the leagues are populated by tribes of all nations. His teammates are from Trinidad, India, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, Jamaica, Guyana. Hans, in short, is the only pale face among them. He strikes up a friendship of sorts with an umpire, a Trinidadian named Chuck Ramkison. Ramkison thinks big. He harbors an ambition to erect a state-of-the-art cricket field on the grounds of the derelict Floyd Bennett Field in Brooklyn. The listless Hans gets caught up in this fantasy, but as he becomes more entangled with Ramkison, he discovers that, like Jay Gatsby, Chuck Ramkison is yet another flowering of that all-American hybrid, the go-getter with the soul of a dreamer, disastrously crossed with the brain of a con man. If you're going to invoke Gatsby as often as O'Neill does in Netherland, and by the way, catching all those references to ferry boats, Jewish frontmen, and death by drowning is undeniably part of the insider fun of reading this novel, you'd better be able to acquit yourself honorably against the sheer gorgeousness of Fitzgerald's prose. That O'Neill does. And believe me, I can't think of many novelists I would put within spitting distance of Fitzgerald. O'Neill is a wide-ranging stylist, capable of whipping out unexpected but precisely right words like peregrinating, and also adroit at muted comedy, like when Hans looks at Ramkison's hairy chest and spots a necklace's gold drool. But where O'Neill really soars is in his appreciation of the shadowy spaces in and around New York City. Like Fitzgerald, O'Neill is a poet of retrospection, a mood that suits Hans in his depression and New York City directly after 9/11. Hence, we're treated here to haunting descriptions of the aforementioned Floyd Bennett Field, with its runways overgrown with grass and ghosts of dashing aviators, Greenwood Cemetery, with its graves of Tiffany's and Steinways, and even lowly Flatbush Avenue, which Hans describes as being crammed with hole-in-the-wall premises devoted to the beautification of those body parts that continue to thrive after death. Hair palaces, nail palaces, barber shops, African hair braiding specialists, and wig and hairpiece suppliers. In the decades since its publication, The Great Gatsby itself has become something of a green light for novelists, a literary ideal to be reached for but never quite grasped. O'Neill in Netherland runs faster, stretches out his arms farther, and approaches the glow of greatness.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Netherland by Joseph O'Neill. You can read an excerpt from Netherland on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show.